Okay, so it's September 16th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the Badger 2 Medicine Oral History Project in Montana. And today I'm talking with Dan Smiley. And Dan, could you start out by just talking a little bit about your personal history or background, where you grew up, how you were educated, maybe how you made your way to Montana if you're not from here?
I grew up in upstate New York and visited the Badger 2 made it first in 1957 when I was 16 years old. And my trip at that time was to visit relatives who had homesteaded there, specifically George Jennings, who took out the homestead and what became the Jennings Ranch. I spent 3 weeks there that summer, enjoyed it very much, and kind of got to me, so I came back every chance I had. Lots of vacations all through high school, college, and went to Haverford College, graduated with a degree in engineering, and 3 days after I graduated, I moved to Montana, 1964, the week after the big June 8th flood, which essentially devastated that part of Montana, swept across the reservation, wiped up Birch Dam, killed 32 people, drowned in the 64 flood. I taught school in Hart Butte from 64 through 65 in the grade school there. I did not have a teaching certificate, so the state wouldn't let me teach a second year. I went pursued jobs in engineering in Conrad. I was a civil engineer. I spent every moment I could back at the up in the Badger 2 made it at the homestead place. I contracted to buy HES 712, which is the Jennings Dew Ranch, in 1965. And again, always had to have real work with a salary to make payments and to try to get established in the cattle business. And that's how I started.
Mm-hmm. So when did you buy it from George Jennings?
Bought from Tex Hughes. George Jennings homesteaded that in about 1916 or 17. I think he actually moved there in 1914. Under the Homestead Act, you had to prove up on these homesteads, and that took a while. You had to build some structures and raise a garden, and there were certain requirements that had to be met. The survey on the place it was done in 1917, and the patent was signed by Woodrow Wilson in 1920. And I could get into how he got into the dude business a little later on. But he sold that property to a fellow named Tex Hughes in 1941. Tex owned it as long as he lived. He died in 1964, early in the year, and I bought the property from his estate. So I was the third owner of the property.
So before we started here, you reminded me a little of the legal history of the area. I suspect we ought to probably go back to that and get to where the Homestead Act was in place in the area.
The Badger 2 Medicine was originally part of the declared Blackfeet Reservation. In the late 1880s, the government, and I suspect it's because they thought there was gold in the area, wanted to buy back the part of that reservation, the western part of the original reservation that lies on the mountain front. So they negotiated with the tribe to acquire that property back for $1.5 million. And the agreement with the tribe was signed by 357 Native Americans, who, if I recall the wording, were considered to be the majority of the male members of the tribe. And of course, even in this country, women had no right to vote till 1920, so I imagine that the Indian women were also considered to have no legal status in that regard. So the government bought that back. The reservation boundary was surveyed in 1895, the boundary as it exists today. And by early 1900s, particularly after the 1910 fire, people became interested in homesteading there. And by time the Forest Service had been created, which was 1906, and so these homesteads, I believe, were under the authority of the Homestead Act that pertained to national forest lands, and they required a separate survey for each homestead, because the area had not been surveyed by the General Land Office as part of the rectangular system that we know in all the western United States. So each of those homesteads had its own special survey, and they're designated HES number or something, so mine was HES 712.
Why the 1910 fire? Why did that spur homesteading?
Because it wiped everything out.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the 1910 fire, but 1910 was a phenomenal fire year in the northwest United States. The fires were many of them, probably hundreds of them. They burned across most of eastern Washington, most of northern Idaho, and most of western Montana. If I recall, people telling, yeah, they started in August and they never got any big snows till well into October. So they had about 3 months of fires. Essentially burned all the timber off the Badger Two Medicine area. There are a few pockets of old growth that survived the fire, mostly on the north slopes. And even today, we can see snags from the 1910 fire. I was gathering cows over there last week and noted that there's still these black snags that are left from 1910. And some of those higher elevation points, like Sundance Mountain and Upper Hyde Creek, there was timber, 8-inch diameter timber. I think it was probably limber pine. Those snags are still there. They're starting to fall over. It's pretty high, dry, cold climate, but those snags are still there. And the regrowth is just barely starting, even after 100 years.
Mm.
So it strikes me that when people talk about timber in the Badger Two Medicine in some of that area, we're talking about a rotation. It's hundreds of years before
mm-hmm.
it will get to that same size.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, after the 1910 fire, what comes back in is all kinds of grasses and forbs. This is nature's way of revegetating. George Jennings was working for the railroad out of Whitefish, and he told me that he didn't say use the word conscripted, but I suspect that the Great Northern trains weren't even running through a lot of that time. So the government took all these people wherever they could find able bodies to fight this fire, which I imagine was pretty tough in those days without helicopters and retardant and so forth. And George said that he was sent over to the Badger Two Medicine area along with a guy named Bert Pond, who worked on the railroad and had a homestead right above Dog Gun Lake about the same time George started his, and I suppose several others. They did whatever they could to fight the fire, and he told me that it was just a fascinating country to him. He grew up in southern Idaho, loved to hunt and fish. He was actually a demonstrator for the Remington Arms Company at one time. He went around to various fairs showing off his shooting skills at crack shot. And when he saw that Badger Two Medicine, he said, I just had to go there. And he had married a woman, Emma, don't know what her maiden name was, from Whitefish. And they moved over there to homestead, just because he loved to hunt and trap and fish. They squatted on this land that they eventually patented. Started out that way. He said the first thing they built, they threw up a little bit of a log cabin and didn't have any way to get lumber in there for a door, so they used an elk skin for a door their first year. And no windows. Too cold if you wanted to put a window in there. Eventually, he became a guide to Louis Hill, who was son of Jim Hill, who built the Great Northern Railroad. And I don't know how that connection was made, but he and Louis became fast friends. And every time that Louis came out here to hunt or fish or recreate, he'd use George as a guide. And I think this association must have started before the Glacier Park was established, which was 1910. The park is clear because George took Louis hunting many times in what's now Glacier Park, and the Enabling Act for Glacier Park prohibits hunting. There's no way around that. In the hotel on East Glacier. I remember George pointing out all the various trophy heads in there. He said, oh, I remember when we shot this one up in such and such a place. He remembers the big columns, the Douglas fir columns in the Glacier Park Hotel in East Glacier. It must be 3 to 4 feet in diameter. They're Doug fir. Remember when they brought those in on the trains from the coast. I didn't log those around here.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very fond of Louis Hill and vice versa. And Louis Hill had two sons, Louis Jr., and I don't know what the other one's name was. And by that time, it had been 1914. George told me that Louis said, George, I'm going to send these two boys out there this summer. I want you to make men out of them. So Louis Jr. would have been 14 years old. Again, I don't know the other boy's name.
And these are the grandsons of Jim Hill.
Grandsons of Jim Hill. And so George had started to make enough improvements on his homestead by then that he had a place to keep him, kept him all summer. And I guess he must have made men out of them, because Louis Hill Jr. came back almost every year. He died in 1994 at age 94. And he'd stop by and visit us, and I did some survey for him because he and the Hill Family Foundation owned property in various places, probably all over the state. And he'd want to find the corners or the boundaries on some of his properties were, so he'd send me a note, and I'd go find the corners and do whatever survey work he wanted. I'm a licensed surveyor in the state. And every year we'd get a can of maple syrup from Louis Hill Jr. for Christmas, right up there to the year he died, because he owned, of course, all his property in Minnesota, and he had lots of maple trees. And,
mm-hmm.
and anybody that ever did anything for him, they'd get a can of maple syrup for Christmas. Very interesting chap, and still have occasional correspondence with his daughter, Marie Hill Harper, who lives in Canada. Her husband raises red deer. But at one point, after George had proved up on the homestead, Louis said, and the railroad had built the hotels in the park by then, this would have been by the 20s, and Louis suggested that maybe they needed a good stopping spot for day riders. Had day rides that went out of the hotel in East Glacier. And the homestead is about 6 miles from town, up a very, very scenic route across the Two Medicine River and up kind of a steep narrow canyon. So, of course, George being accommodated, he and Emma said, yeah, we'd be glad to do that. And these day riders started showing up. And it probably takes, for dudes, it probably take almost 3 hours to ride out that far. So they'd ride 3 hours and stop, and of course, George and Emma would fix it fabulous, sit down, hot meal for him for lunch, and they'd ride back. By about the second year that happened, these people started saying, George, we'd like to come and stay all summer at this place. So they said, oh yeah, we can do that. And pretty soon he's building cabins for these dudes. And he got up, told me he had as many as 32 people staying there at one time. That's the most they could accommodate. And he said, when that happened, boy, the help would have to sleep in the hay barn, because they had one small cabin with three or four, I think it's just three little separate rooms for some of the help. And they actually use their beds for the dudes and help them sleep on the hay.
Was it just a pack trail into there at that time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know when the first road was built. I've got a picture which I can show you that taken, I don't know when it was taken, but George had an old Chevrolet pickup. I think it was in 1927, called a Rocky Boy. And this picture is in the middle of winter, and it shows Rocky Boy parked there. So by then there was mm-hmm. a road. It's just, I imagine it's probably pretty close to the existing road,
which is the Hart Butte cutoff.
Came off the Hart Butte cutoff road and mm-hmm. past Dogon Lake.
Okay.
Because the topography going straight northwest towards East Glacier was no way of even today. They couldn't make when the Seismographs came in the 50s. Their DHs finally quit in some of those roads. Two Medicine can be a problem. George and Emma had a cable strung across the Two Medicine and a little car they could pull themselves across the river in high water. Because even they can't cross it with a horse if the water's up, which can happen any time, but mostly in spring runoff.
I want to go back to when he was first squatting there. I assume he was squatting on the land that became the Jennings Ranch.
Right, and that's just a term we use,
squatting.
I mean, they actually had to build some
sure.
facility.
D- Do you have any idea, or did he ever talk to you about how many other folks were in the area at the time, homesteading, attempting to homestead, and also if before the homesteading started, and then, you know, you mentioned the 1910 fires as being fairly significant. Before the 1910 fires, were there tribal members living there before they signed it over or sold it?
I'll talk about the tribal members first. To my knowledge, the tribal members did not live in the Badgerton Medicine. It was rugged country. Archie Sankador was born in 1900, lived on the Heartbeat Cutoff Road. His sons and grandmother, most of his direct children are dead now, but his grandson still ranched there. Archie went to the Carlisle School in Pennsylvania, graduated there in 1919, came back to reservation, was very successful. One time I think he had 800 cattle and two bands of sheep, which would be 2,000 sheep. He was on the tribal council many years, was chairman several years. I think a very respected individual. I had the highest respect of anybody could have for him. He's just a wonderful neighbor. I can tell you a story. After I'd been there a couple of years, he came up one day and he said, "You know, you need a good mountain horse if you're going to come up here and run cows." I said, "I got one down there down at Sapu's," which is his son, and he's in Sapu's right on the Heartbeat Cutoff Road. "I think it'd be pretty good for you." I said, "Okay, yeah, you're right, I need a horse." And I went down there and looked at the horse, and it was a fine horse. It was a sorrel gelding. And walked up there, and he had a whole corral full of horses. He had probably 100 horses. One time he canned 2 semi-loads because he just had too many. And he said, "Now this horse got the same name as all the rest, S.O.B. And, "How much went for the horse?" "Oh, how about $75? I said, "That'd be okay." I said, "Bought the horse." "Well, the reason he got the horse is I sold the bull a year earlier and I didn't have any clue what the price of the bull should be. And I said, "Well, how about $200? And he didn't say anything. "Well, that too much?" He says, "No, that's not too much. And the bull was probably worth $350. So he was getting even.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say anything for a whole year. But getting even with me for giving him a good deal on the bull. He gave me a superb deal on the horse.
Mm-hmm.
But he told me that the Indians would go up onto what, in that area to hunt. Particularly in the fall to gather berries, probably the Sarvish berries to make pemmican, and to hunt elk when they were fat. I suspect that by the early 1900s, the elk had been pretty well pushed off the plains by the homesteading. Mm-hmm. Reed, Lewis, and Clark and their elk all the way down to Missouri, well into the Midwest. But when the homesteaders came along with the elk, the only place they had left was the mountains, the front range. So Archie said that they would go on hunting trips up there, and they actually used our hay meadow as a camping spot, set up temporary camps, and they'd flesh out the hides there so they didn't have to pack all that stuff back and actually cure some of them. And he found something in the roadway right here. Riding into our place at one time, this is a chunk of stone. And he brought it down the house. He said, "I've never seen one of these, but I think it's man-made. You know, it looks like a helmet."
Right.
And
looks like a helmet or a small bowler hat or something
exactly.
Like that.
And if
but
you
clearly
measure it,
one piece of stone.
One piece of stone, and it's been kind of scratched around. And this didn't come out of a crick, I don't think. And he said, and he measured this in 7 8.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a hat size.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "What do you think it is?" He said, "The only thing you could think of is when they were camped up there curing out these elk hides, that they use this as a form for a headdress, because a headdress has got it's like a skull cap, and then they stick all the feathers in it."
Mm-hmm.
And so they would stretch the elk hide over this, tie it down, and voila, you have what could be a headdress cap. And I showed this to some archaeologists, and I found anybody seen something like this.
Mm.
But
they agreed that it looked,
well, I said, it's
human
possible.
Worked.
Yeah, they said.
Yeah.
They said, "We can't say that it is, but we can't say that it isn't."
Mm-hmm.
But that was Archie's interpretation. Yeah, point being that the Indians would go up their camp and hunt at the right time of year. Another neighbor, Bill Big Springs, who was born in 1916. The tribe hasn't known for 1920, and he was always at odds with the tribe over a number of things. But interesting fellow. He went to the as a delegate from Montana to the Republican convention in 1976, and I think it was in Miami. And he was Glacier County Commissioner, and he had 3 lawsuits against the tribe, and he won all of them. I think he was a full blood. And he wrote a letter, and it was to the local papers, and I failed to save a copy of it. Said the same thing about the Badger 2 medicine, that they didn't really like it that much because it was tough country. It's hard to get around in. Couldn't haul a travelway around in there. You could get around in horses. But they did hunt there, but they didn't really occupy it much. Mm-hmm. Now that's two pieces of hearsay, but I consider them fairly reliable. Because, of course, mm-hmm. I knew those people pretty well, and they were not people that exaggerated very much. So that's about Indian occupation. That's all I would be able to mm-hmm. contribute on that. As far as occupation, when George got there, he said that, of course, being somebody that loved to hunt and fish, he had dogs. These people all had dogs. They didn't have horses. Horses were expensive, and you had to feed them. Dogs, there was all kinds of game there. After the fire, when the browse comes in, the game just blossoms much. It's the big game because they have all this forage now. So these people all had dogs, and he had packs for his dogs. And they go to town, and he had hunting dogs and packs. So the only problem was that they'd invariably run into a coyote or a bear or something, and the dogs would go nuts and take off. And he'd spend most of his time retrieving stuff out of these packs that they'd torn off in the brush from their supposed trip to town for supplies. Said the first thing he got was a cow, was a milk cow, because you could cream butter, and something to feed hogs if you happen to have a hog. And he said before he ever got any kind of horse equipment, horses or equipment, he would cut the hay on the hay meadow there on the homestead with a scythe, shock it up by hand, and then pack it on his back into the barn so he'd have hay for his milk cow in the winter. Life was not easy. He had help in building some of the cabins. A guy named Slim Tobin, I think his given name was Charles, lived over on what's now near the highway. And Slim was a superb craftsman, because he built the lodge and the dining room building there, and a big stone fireplace. They're still standing. There were about 10 or 11 cabins on that place. By the time I got there, 2 of them had fallen into disrepair. And over the years, I've managed to at least save them to the point that they're usable. When they originally built them, they just laid the bottom log on a couple of flat stones, and pretty soon they rotted out. I, over many years, managed to jack them up and get concrete on them.
Were they using logs off the property or from the two men?
No, wherever they could find them. The fire took out most of the timber. Mm-hmm. They, we can see on the picture that the old growth that survived the fire, there was enough logs to build some cabins.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true throughout most of the Badger 2 medicine. I know there's a fellow named Glenn Smiley that homesteaded, well, I think actually Tobin bought Smiley's homestead, no relation that I know of. And he would hire crews to go logging in somewhere, but they would go, they would actually leave the homestead and go back up in the Badger 2 medicine to wherever there was some timber. I mean, there were patches that did survive the fire. And they would drag logs down, and there was a fellow, I don't know his name, had a sawmill on the upper 2 medicine about where it comes out of the, well, it's not really a canyon, but it comes out of the steep country, going up towards Badger Cabin. The 2 medicine makes a big turn, it's kind of hitting northwest and kind of turns to the northeast. Sawmill flats. There's a sawmill there. There's no homestead right there.
The Badger Cabin you mentioned is a Forest Service cabin.
It's a Forest Service cabin, right? Okay. It's over a small divide from upper 2 Medicine over into Badger Creek. And I remember up on something called Whisker Ridge, which is not too far from that sawmill flats, there was an odd-looking structure. Just some logs looked like a loading dock. And sure enough, it was, where they would drag logs up there, and then they could take a peavey or a cant hook and roll them out onto a wagon. And this is the part of the Badger 2 Medicine that's fairly flat. It's out towards the highway where actually most of the homesteads were taken. So I remember seeing that structure there well into the 70s. It's probably rotted away by now. firewood was a big business, and particularly with all those snags from the 1910 fire. I mean, everybody in East Glacier had to have firewood. So there was, the area served as a firewood supply for many of the people who lived in town and certainly for the homesteaders.
And would people just go out and get their own, or was it homesteaders bringing it into town for?
Well, probably both. Mm-hmm. You know, people in town may not have had, you had to have horses and wagons, all kinds of stuff. So firewood was definitely a business. Mm-hmm. If you had the equipment, well, you could get it on your own. Kind of like today, you know, family goes out and cuts firewood, you can hire somebody to bring it into you, same sort of a deal.
So you mentioned that Archie St. Goddard, how do you pronounce his last name again?
Archie's dad was Ozzy Sankador, which is French-Canadian, so the French pronunciation would be Sankador, but it's been kind of bastardized even back in the 50s, saying Sankador.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. So he had sheep as well as cattle there.
Yeah.
Was he the only one? Were there other working ranches at the
time?
Oh,
sheep were big.
Mm-hmm.
Sheep and cattle can complement each other because they don't eat the same forage. So you can, to some extent, you can run them on the same range. Sheep were, main people on the reservation had sheep. And again, people from the outside came in, brought sheep in for summer grazing. Probably the biggest commercial use of the Badger Two Medicine has been fee grazing by the Forest Service, dealing directly with the natural resource, you know, gas and oil, no coal, not enough timber to be commercial. So grazing has really been the only significant commercial use. There's a fellow from Starbuck, Washington, Drewer, I think was his name. He would bring a train load of sheep, graze them on the reservation and take them into the forest. And I think he grazed them on Archie's property, as well as Archie having his own sheep, and then take them onto the forest. The problem was that the grizzly bears and the coyotes like sheep. And even into the 60s, I can remember the government had, they called them government trappers, and these were people who hired to control predators. And they'd shoot grizzly bears, they'd shoot black bears, they'd shoot coyotes, but mostly they set traps for the coyotes. They had a kind of a cyanide gun trap that the coyote would pull some bait and give him a shot of cyanide in the face, and that would be the end of Mr. Coyote. And so probably the predator situation just made it pretty tough on sheep.
Mm-hmm.
They could find range where there weren't grizzly bears. Grizzly bears and sheep were a conflict. Coyotes and sheep were a conflict. Black bear will go eat one sheep. Grizzly bear will walk through a herd and just whack him and kill. Well, one night Archie said he killed 40 of his sheep. And it was one bear just for sport. None of those animals are a conflict with cattle. I don't know when the cattle started in the Badger Two Medicine. I know they were there by the 40s, maybe earlier. And the Teton Livestock Association, which is an association of four or five permittees, as long as I can remember, and I was a member for many years, has run about 460 pairs up in that area. They used to trail them up from Shoto. Most of these ranchers live in Shoto. The Peebles brothers, the Stott brothers, Swanson's are in there now. Swanson's came in the 70s because the Forest Service took away the range someplace else. And in about 1972 or 3, the last of the sheep were on the forest, and they still had the forage available. So the Swanson's became members of the Teton Livestock Association in 73, I think. It might have been 72. So they would trail them up from Shoto, about 100 miles. I remember helping them trail them up and back. Takes about 5 days. Cows move about 20 miles a day. Horses probably move twice that because they're back and forth chasing the cows. And by 10 or 15 years ago, it just became so difficult to cross the reservation that they all truck the cows up here now.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1966, 65 or 66, the Forest Service established a rest rotation type of grazing as opposed to just turning everything out all at once. It was a little difficult for the ranchers to swallow at first because they had to come up in the middle of summer and find these 400 and some cows and move them all. But it pretty soon became apparent that this is a better deal for the range, and so now it's just kind of an accepted practice.
So describe the practice before that.
On the allotment, which I don't know, might have been 20,000 acres, because they could go all the way back to Badger Cabin. That's 15 miles from those homesteads. They just turn a whole bunch of cows out and go look for them in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of the rest rotation is that any particular allotment within the total range is used at a different time each year. So one year it's used early in the season, next time middle season, and the third year it's used at the end of the season when the grasses have all matured. The seed heads are viable. The cows walk through and they knock the seeds off and trample them in the ground and plant seeds. And then it's rested 2 years after that. That's kind of the ideal rest rotation mm-hmm. system. You get rugged country like the Badger 2 Medicine, where the snow drifts just wipe out fences, and it's sometimes isn't quite as pure as it is in the books, but the concept is a good one, and the association tries to adhere to it.
So in switching to the rest rotation, that meant fencing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's.
And who was responsible for that?
Association.
The grazers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
They have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Forest Service sometimes provides materials, but when they don't have any money, then the grazers have to do it. Association built a reservation line fence, which was supposed to be a nice government property line. The government should have built it,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have the money or the people. So the association, it goes all the way from the highway to Palookaville, which is 5 or 6 miles,
mm-hmm.
and maintains it all.
And that's the line between the reservation and the Badger 2 Medicine.
Right, property
mm-hmm.
boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And if the fence isn't there, then of course the reservation cows will eat off the range on the forest. Association maintains that, maintains all the division fences, maintains the fence along the highway. They built that all the way from the reservation boundary to almost to Summit, all along the highway.
So and are any of the permittees from the reservation?
No.
Okay.
No, not currently.
Mm-hmm. No. So I want to go back to, we're talking about the Jennings Ranch and the first sort of dude experiences there when George Jennings first started running as a dude ranch, as an outgrowth of pack trips from Glacier.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about how that expanded and what that led to for the ranch.
He was an engaging guy. In today's world, you'd say that he and Ma, I think, told his wife Ma, and they never had any kids, but Mrs. Jennings, they were so accommodating, and everybody that met them just loved them. And so they were the draw.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the country's pretty close too, of course, but they were just really, really interesting, fun people. So it's not hard for me to see how people want to come back and hang around. I mean, he always had some kind of activity. He could sit in a lodge at night and have little games of the hands for young people, just keep them fascinated. He could tell stories, new wildlife, new animals. One of the things he commented to me, I was teasing his dog once, and he was so gentle. He said, it's just good that you never should tease animals. He's right. If you want animals to work and respond in a certain way, you don't tease them and give them mixed signals. And I think the most severe form of criticism I ever heard him say of anybody is something like, I've never seen it done that way before. I mean, you got the message, but it was
right.
A pretty gentle.
So what did he do with, I guess, dude ranch tourists or visitors?
Yeah.
And what was the season like, or were there multiple seasons for it?
Yeah, because it's long winters, really couldn't get around there. I can't imagine that their season opened up much before June. So they got June, July, August, and a little bit into September for dude stuff. And then that's when families were free in the summer. Kids would be on vacation. They would have breakfast cookouts. They'd have supper cookouts. There's a breakfast nook, a place way down on the creek, Supper Peak, which is a beautiful spot up on the reservation to watch the sunsets from. And it's such a good viewpoint, you could even see the stacks at the Anaconda Mill and refinery in Great Falls on a clear day. But there was always something going on. He always had an activity. horse races, they do brandings, just always something to keep them busy. Hunting trips, of course, are big. In the fall, they take pack trips. And he even took some that went all the way through what's now the Bob Marshall. They start out up at East Glacier, and they end up at Ovando, and they bring the horses back on the train from Ovando. There used to be railroad tracks to Ovando then. They're not now. They're long gone ever since I can remember. But you can still see the railroad graded Ovando. So they'd hunt all the way through the Bob Marshall sometimes. I don't know how in the world they got the meat taken care of. Maybe just ate it all. I don't know. And I got some stories of some of their big hunts. Some of these guys that write stories. And he had some pretty well-known people there. Clark Gable used to come and stay there. I actually got some letters from Gable, one of them saying, sure enjoyed that last hunt. I'm going to be back next year, blah, 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 blah. The Bernadotte family from Sweden, Countess Bernadotte, came several years. Their Swedish royalty, her husband was instrumental in getting Jews out from under the Nazi thumb, I think mostly in Poland, and he mysteriously died right about the beginning of the war. Let's see, the Hill family, of course, they were faithful, gained as much as they could. A family named North, and I think they had the patent on the machine that sews the tops of grain bags closed. And they came year after year after year. They actually put up a scholarship at Bozeman in wildlife studies in Georgia's name in the 60s. So people just flocked around because they were interested in liking them.
So it sounds like it was pretty high-end visitors, people who could afford to spend a month, 2 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I got a brochure lately, and I think it said it's a week cost $65.
That doesn't sound high-end today now, does it?
And actually, that brochure was from when Tex Hughes owned it, so that would have been as late as in the 40s.
So, you know, you started out saying that George Jennings began with one milk cow, didn't have horses yet, but now we're to a point where he has enough horses to outfit a maximum of 32 people. Mm-hmm. Was he then growing more feed there? Was the feed grown on the Badger 2 medicine?
They had winter grazing. Mm-hmm. Horses are tough. In the reservation, they rarely feed horses still. Mm-hmm. And it's good grass. So they had winter grazing. They had a permit from the forest to winter graze back in High Creek and Metla Coulee, and I suppose into Box Creek. And it's important that the animals have water in the winter, because if they just lick snow for water, it's not very good for them. They can get impacted and suffer to the point of not making it. But there were enough riffles that were swift enough that they didn't freeze over in the winter, so it was good winter country for them. Mm-hmm. They grazed their all winter. Now, the Forest Service took that away when Tex Hughes had it, I remember, because then he had to buy hay for his horses. He probably sent them down on the reservation, made a deal with Archie to graze his horses. Archie had 100 horses. And, mm-hmm. Imagine, I think when I was there in the 50s, Tex only had about 8 or 10 horses. So Archie was such a nice guy, he would have done something for Tex that way. But I remember it was a big issue because Tex only wrote a letter to Senator Mansfield. and typical congressional response, well, we're sorry this happened, I'll look into it, but nothing ever changed.
Meaning he had the loss of his grazing rights for his horses?
Yeah,
okay.
For the horses. Mm-hmm. And that probably was, well, probably true for all of them. Archie told me that there was a fellow named Al Gordon at a homestead over towards the highway. He was in the food business as well. And he said, Archie's take on it was this, the Forest Service made a crook out of Al Gordon. Because Al would, and this was in summer, because he used to graze his horses. In summer, he didn't have enough pasture in his own place. And he'd run his horses out at night, and during the daylight, he'd bring them back in, so they'd never catch him with the horses out there. So they made a crook out of Al Gordon. But I suspect that maybe the range wasn't in the problem for it, because particularly in the early part of the growing season, if you have a whole bunch of horses out there, that's not going to do the range much favor.
So did George Jennings run it as a dude ranch up until the point that he sold it to Tex Hughes? Okay.
Yeah.
And then Tex Hughes took it, and did he continue with it as a
dude
ranch?
He tried, but he he's a kind of an engaging character, and but he wasn't George Jennings, and again, the war came along, and things just changed.
How did the war change things in terms of
nobody went anywhere, and rationing. I mean, gosh, you couldn't buy sugar, you couldn't buy tires, you couldn't buy all kinds of things in the war. I've even got George's old ration booklet, and you were allowed to buy so much of these critical commodities each month, and you had these little coupons that looked like cardboard pennies or something that you could allow you to buy this stuff. I suppose there's some kind of a black market, but nobody had any money.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody traveled. All the trains were hauling troops around. You just kind of shut everything down.
Mm-hmm.
The whole country went to the war effort. And of course, I was alive, but I don't remember any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having a victory garden at home. That's what they call them. Everybody was encouraged to have their own garden. You wouldn't put a drain on the transportationist economy. I learned to hate parsnips because we ate a lot of parsnips. Always hated them. Out of our victory garden.
Was anybody farming at all on the Badger 2 Medicine? Was there any irrigation going on?
No.
Yeah.
Once in a while, somebody would plow up a meadow and try to raise a hay crop. But that was pretty rare. I know on the homestead one time before I got there, Tex had hired somebody to come in, didn't have a plow himself. Ray Lutz had another homesteader not far away. He had a tractor, one bottom plow, and he bought a 7 acres to put oats in, and that was it, and put it back to grass.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a place that's suitable for farming, and I think anybody would try to figure it out pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you have a photo that leads you to believe that the road, that Hartbutte Cutoff Road, was in there before 27, because there's a photo of the Rocky Boys at the truck.
Yeah, that was the name of
it. Was in there by then. Were there people, and I guess George Jennings as well, that lived in there year-round? Was he a year-round resident?
Yeah. They lived, that was their big season, if they weren't doing it, was the trapping.
In the winter.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say something that is hard to believe. He said that he had 3 trap lines. He'd visit them twice a week, every third day. Monday he'd go on A, and Tuesday B, and Wednesday C, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday take Sunday off. And that I had it in my mind, he said they're 25 miles long. And I can't imagine somebody going 25 miles every day for 6 days a week. That may be possible. I mean, you can walk 25 miles if you're in shape. And if he caught something, he'd skin it out on the spot rather than pack the whole body in and skin it later.
Mm-hmm.
He said that there's a reed that grows, maybe the cow parsnip, that's hollow. And he would cache those every creek he came to, so he could just stick that thing down through the snow and use it like a big straw to suck up water out of the creek rather than having to dig down and get water and not pack water.
Mm-hmm.
When he went hunting, he told me he carried 3 bullets. He was a good enough shot. He'd never shoot anything more than 3 things. He says, it's just too much extra weight if you're going to carry more bullets than that. So 25 miles seems like an awful lot, but that's what sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing how tough conditions were, maybe they did.
What was he trapping?
The good one, of course, was mink. Beaver were pretty good, and otter. There's not a lot of them around, but they trapped when they could. And muskrats, those were not something that they would spend a lot of time after on a long trap line. Dogon Lake, even in the 60s, when he was in his 80s, where he'd trap muskrats because he could just walk out on the ice, and they're only $3 or $4 a piece, and they're real easy to catch and easy to skin. Mink was a gringo one.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't waste a bullet putting out of its misery. He could press their heart, cut off their circulation to put them down. So he tried to have a muskrat once, and a muskrat, any trap you have a chain on it, so it's secured to something. And he misjudged the distance, and the muskrat lunged at his throat, and he stopped. The muskrat stopped just a few inches short of his throat. So he says, I used a bullet on that one. But I remember trapping rabbits and things with him, and he just pressed their heart till they quit breathing.
Mm-hmm. So when you bought the place from Hughes, yeah. Was it still a dude rancher that had gone under?
I doubt he'd had any clients for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
He was just living there.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, Carmela, taught school in Browning, and so he'd actually moved to Browning in the winter. He had a caretaker staying there, Jack Baker, Whispering Jack. Anybody that's been around East Glacier for a while knows of Whispering Jack. He's one of these fellows that just ended up there and just stayed. So he hired Jack to help him put up ice one year. There's no refrigeration, no power in the early days, and up on the ridge, about a mile plus, a little over a mile from the ranch, there are a couple of lakes. Not very big, probably acre in size, half acre. And they cut ice on those lakes and hauled it down with a sleigh. Well, the reason, and it's surprising that country, on top of these ridges, there's these little pothole lakes. And of course, the reason they went up there to cut the ice is all the downhill haul
mm-hmm.
on a sleigh. They hired Jack in 1950 to help him cut ice. And I moved there after Tex had died, while Jack was still there, and he went to the home in Browning in about 1980. He was an engaging character, full of stories and BS, and a voice you could hear a mile away. And Bill Bigsprings told me that's because Jack spent 2 or 3 years living in East Glacier in a cabin with a guy named Bill Twist that was mostly deaf, and Jack had to yell at him to make him hear. And he never lost the habit of yelling.
So wait a minute. There's a guy named Whispering Jack, but he yells at everybody.
Well, of course, that's how you get the name.
Right. So you bought the place.
Yep.
And what were your visions of it? Or, I mean, what drew you to buy it other than having been there as a young man?
Well, I'm not quite sure
mm-hmm.
exactly why. After I came to Montana the first time in the 50s, and I started working on ranches, mostly over in the Bear Paw Mountains, some of the large ranches over in that country. I just got to love that. I thought, well, I really like the Badger Two Medicine area. It's probably an attraction to the area, and it was an excuse to be able to do stuff there, hang out there. And bought George's cows. He had 8 cows, I think, or 7 and a bull. I'm not quite sure. Anyhow, I bought those and started to build up a herd from that. And pretty naive about a lot of things, but learned and had good neighbors with the Sankadors and the Big Springs. And that's the way it was. Everybody helped everybody because their cows would wander up there, and I could get them, put them in the corral, and no telephone, of course, and get word to them. Yeah, those yearlings you're looking for, I got 3 of them here. Oh, okay, I'll be out and get them. And it was a good sense of cooperation. Still is. I mean, that's how it has to be when you're essentially open range country. So I wanted to have cows, but I was stuck with all these buildings, didn't know what to do with. So I'm at various points, I think for about 6 or 7 years, I leased them out to a couple of guys from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and had an environmental studies camp for high school students there. And they ran a program, I guess, let's say 6 or 7 years. Another time, leased out the facilities to a fellow from Browning, Ed Anderson, a tribal member that had a outfitter and guide permit from the Lewis and Clark Forest, and I had a special use permit to operate on the Lewis and Clark Forest, and an outfitter and guide permit from the state of Montana. I had both those things in order to do the outfitting. That didn't last too many years. He was marginally successful at it, and we just kind of mutually agreed to sever that relationship. But mostly used it as a place where I could go with a family, raise 4 boys, who all love the place, and a lot of friends. We had so many friends stop by that I ended up mostly cooking and taking people on rides and not doing much myself. So, but it's a beautiful country, and once it gets in your blood, it's tough to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just spent most of last week helping the Livestock Association round up cows again.
So was the, I don't want to say the demise of the dude ranch there. It just ceased to be a dude ranch for whatever reasons. the war. Tex Hughes not maintaining it as a dude ranch. The personality of George Jennings obviously not being there. Was that going on all over the Badger 2 Medicine with other dude ranches or outfitting, that was sort of fading away?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think there are any no dude ranches in
mm-hmm.
Badger 2 Medicine now.
But there's still quite a bit of hunting there.
Yeah, but it's there is some outfitting that goes on, but the outfitting has to go on the Lewis and Clark Forest
mm-hmm.
because there's just not enough private property. I think there's, in fact, I've got the numbers right handy here.
Okay. So the outfitting is now primarily done by people who are not living in the Badger 2 Medicine, but are bringing people into the areas that are national forests?
I don't know who the outfitters are on the national forest now. There's a fellow named Richard Jackson, lived in East Glacier. I think he bought 10 acres from Morris Sankador on the reservation. Had a very successful outfitting operation. They would leave from Morris's place, which is right by Palookaville, go up over White Rock Pass into the Badger Cabin area, spend most of a week there, ride out over to the highway. You'd have people pick them up there, and then if some of them wanted to experience the trailing the horses, back around through Box Creek, Hyde Creek, Mettler Coulee, over to Palookaville, almost probably 8 miles, and you could trail the horses back there. So you'd have a week rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And the association hired Richard Jackson as kind of a caretaker because they put 80 head back in the Badger Cabin area. And for a while, they would be bothering Richard's hunting camp. So association said, well, geez, you know, if we hire Richard to watch the cows back there, he can get these his dudes to chase cows. And that's another experience for him to control the cows. And he was a great hand. He got killed and his horse bucked him off in Badger Cabin. He was a superb horseman. 55 years old, something like that, and it was a safe horse, which I guess is never a guarantee. Fell on his neck, and that was the end of him right there. So he was the last really successful one.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is that in outfitting on National Forest, you think there's a lot of acres, but really the outfitters kind of have to have an exclusive area. So one outfitter gets this area, another one gets this area, and I think they only have about two or three outfitters in that whole part
mm-hmm.
of the Lewis and Clark Forest at the Badger Cabin. So it's possible to run a very successful business here, which
mm-hmm.
Richard did. He was good. He's good with the people. He spent winter making contacts and well-organized, good cooks in his camp, and good horses, but there's always never a guarantee of the horses. Information is not entirely current as a few years back. There are 25 patented homesteads in Badger 2 Medicine. They comprise 3,227 acres, 40 different owners, and counting even joint tenancy as one owner. This was in 1988. I just had to dig those numbers up from the county clerk and recorder. This is from the county clerk and recorder.
Okay.
I wrote a letter to all the congressional delegations in 1988. I'll give you a copy of this because it's because they're considering it for wilderness designation.
Mm-hmm. And I see Senator Melcher's name on that. And
I sent it to everybody.
He was the senator, or one of the senators from Montana at the time, who was working on the wilderness bill in the state.
Yeah. But I've sent it to Baucus, and Representative was Pat Williams. And
so what became of the proposal to make it wilderness at that time?
Well, the Indians, of course, resisted. I resisted, and there just wasn't enough push. I think most of the locals did. I wrote up that kind of a summary of what I saw as the situation, sent it to all the congressional delegations, county commissioners, all the other homestead owners that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple issues. The rights of the homesteaders is guaranteed by a patent they got on the land was an issue, because some of the tribal members, because it was once a reservation, feel that they have rights over all this private land, which is which is not the case. Pretty quickly here. Yeah, as I pointed out here in this letter, it says the 1895 agreement reserved certain rights to tribal members. The government bought back the land. They got all the rights, with the exception of three things that was reserved to tribal members. Said the Indians have and do hereby reserve to themselves the right to go on any portion of the lands hereby conveyed, so long as the same shall remain public lands of the United States. Well, when the patents were let on the homesteads, they're no longer public lands of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fact that many of them conveniently forget when they come and cut my fences, they run a snowmobile across there. Second right was the right to remove therefrom wooden timber for agency and school purposes and for the personal uses for houses, fences, and all other domestic purposes. So the Indians had the right to come and cut firewood, fence posts, and domestic purposes, maybe even a right to cut enough lumber to build a house. I mean, the courts might go that far. But again, that's on the public lands, not on the homesteads. And provide further that the said Indians hereby reserve and retain the right to hunt upon said lands and to fish in the streams thereof, so long as the same shall remain public lands of the United States. Again, not on the homesteads. And in accordance with the provisions of the game and fish laws of the state of Montana. So they need to buy a license if they want to hunt there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is frequently not recognized or conveniently forgotten by
mm-hmm.
certain tribal members.
So making
and that's become kind of an issue. It's really unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because there's some confusion about what rights any people have, I
mm-hmm.
guess.
So how is that tied to the opposition of making it wilderness? Because people still outfit, people still hunt, people still fish, and even harvest some timber from the wilderness, right?
Depending on the designation for any given wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
But the restrictions on wilderness would be much more severe than if it's not wilderness. And I think the tribe is against it. Well, I don't know, but I think they feel that their rights, even a very strict interpretation of their rights, would be compromised with wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand that. I would feel anything I wanted to do, there would be compromised with
mm-hmm.
wilderness.
Well, one thing that would certainly be compromised that you just mentioned is running snowmobiles in wilderness.
Yeah. Well, the tribal plan already that the forest has there is can put restrictions on those.
Mm-hmm.
That can all happen without being a wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens when you get a wilderness is that now it's been discovered. I mean, look at what happened on the Middle Fork, the Flathead here, when they declared it a wild and scenic. You know, kind of nobody knew it was there, and it's a great river to go float. And now it's just so popular, you have all these controls on there. So there's kind of an anomaly when somebody gets declared a wilderness. You love it to death.
Right.
So
there have been many people who have claimed that about the national parks, that
same thing,
they get declared a national park because of their pristineness, their monumentalness, their love to death.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
who
was
in favor of wilderness then, at that time?
Wilderness nuts.
And, I mean, groups in particular,
sure,
or individuals?
Yeah. Oh, all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing that maybe I'm misassuming is that as outfitting trips diminished, people continued to hunt individually,
mm-hmm.
as private parties.
Mm-hmm.
Did it increase as time went on, that, you know, hunters from Great Falls or other areas would come and hunt the Badger Two Medicine?
Yeah, the hunting pressure is increased.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quantify it, but certainly
sure.
ever since I've been there. Again, the outfitting was, I mean, you had George Jennings and then Tex and probably Art Trinkle's dad over to Rising Wolf and some of those other ones that would take outfitting trips, but there was plenty of room for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the access was not there. I mean, didn't have snowmobiles, didn't have four-wheelers and motorbikes and so forth. They had a horse at your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a much lower impact.
Mm-hmm. So when did the motorized hunting and recreation
The first
start
snowmobiles
up?
I saw were 1965.
Mm-hmm.
That's about when they started to become popular. And that certainly changed the winter use, because suddenly you get way back in there and bother the elk, poach them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't a lot of that went on to start with. But, boy, now the, well, let's see. Saturday, Labor Day weekend, one of the boys and I took a couple of horses and went over to the summit to the Logan Dock there, rode 2+ miles down to Sonoma Flats, and then rode the horses up the Two Medicine River about 5 miles just for a day trip. There were 23 four-wheelers and 3 motorbikes in just the three
mm-hmm.
or 4 hours we're in there. We passed different
mm-hmm.
ones. And that's just a lot of impact compared
mm-hmm.
to somebody. I mean, it's a beautiful Labor Day weekend day, so you can see why everybody was out. It'd be almost too hot, too warm, 80 degrees and sun and not too much wind, which is an unusual combination for that country, no wind. But it's just tremendous impact.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the...
Talk about the impact. I mean, do you mean roads, effects on wildlife, weeds?
Yeah, exactly. It was probably not until... 1990 or so that the four-wheelers really got to be popular. Maybe a little earlier. But before that, you know, those horse trails, cow trails, and elk trails have been there for a long time. Never changed much. And now the four-wheeler, instead of one track that is defined but doesn't really wash out very much, now there's two tracks, particularly on the hills where they spin them a little bit. Suddenly, you've got a lot more erosion. Knapweed is a big one we notice. In the last 20 years, that's just mushroomed back there. Now, that may be for other reasons, but I don't think horses carry too much knapweed seed. And those axles in the undercarriage of a four-wheeler, I think that carries it pretty well. So that's certainly an impact. People impact. I remember sitting up at the head of Hyde Creek one day, which is an hour or two ride from the ranch somewhere up there, and suddenly we hear four-wheelers coming. We knew the people stopped and talked, and they live over one of the other homesteads. They were caretaking by the homesteads, and they said, oh, we just thought we'd make the loop before supper, you know, so an hour they can go and cover 12 miles there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just an awful lot of country that's impacted by a human being compared to somebody on foot or on horse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cumulative. I mean, it's gradual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not all of a sudden you notice this. But it is gradual. Definitely an impact. Forest Service, I think, is trying to control it. And you can take any side of those, of the tribal plan issues. And it is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But the Forest Service doesn't, they don't have enough people to patrol that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big district. Not very many acres, but gosh, it goes from Glacier Park down to practically the Great Falls, you know, 100 and some miles, and I don't know how many law enforcement officers they have, but isn't very many, isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So what do you, I mean, you sold the property in?
I have to think back, no, it's probably about 98, something like that.
And you sold it to
Doug Hamill.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you, I mean, you still obviously go ride there. You seem fairly well in touch. What do you think looms for Badger 2 Medicine? It seems like there's a new whole, well, I don't know about new, but a set of issues there again. Possible wilderness, possible coal and gas, or gas and oil exploration. Certainly multiple use is an issue.
Yeah.
Where's it headed?
I would guess that oil and gas is, unless there's a national emergency to the point where they're just going to go drill anywhere, I would guess that issue will probably wane. I think just recently I read that some of those companies that had leases there have either sold them to one of the environmental groups or terminated them or something.
Mm-hmm.
Geologically, it has potential for oil and gas, but it's a tough country to drill in. I mean, those guys got cash. They can put a well anywhere they want. But underground, I think it's so fractured that I know one well they drilled, they just gave up because they couldn't maintain pressure in a drilling mud. There are caverns under there, and they just keep losing their drilling mud. So it's very speculative and very expensive to drill there. And now that they can handle these offshore places pretty easily, and they get good deals from the government on the leases on those, There's other places they can get oil. So I would guess that that's going to be less of an issue, at least for a while, than maybe it was perceived to be in the past. I think with the claims that the tribe, and I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but there's a sense, I have a sense that out there there's an interest that individual members, and maybe the tribe as a whole has in that area, that it really creates a cloud on the title of who has the authority to do what. And for instance, something like the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, I think it's, yeah, ERFA, they can wave their hands at the mountains and say, this is a spiritual experience for us. Well, it's a spiritual experience for me. And as Bill Bridgestring's letter, the one I mentioned, he wrote all the papers around there, said that that there never was historically spiritual importance to the tribe. And that unless one can find specific evidence of an important spiritual happening, like some petroglyphs or something, whatever one might find, there really is no basis for that. But that's not how the courts are going to interpret things. And we have not treated the Native Americans well historically. They're always a problem, and we set up these reservations, which is probably a mistake, but they're there, and we have to deal with them. So I think that's really going to make management difficult. Indians, for instance, now they're managing the bison range under contract. I hear or read that it's something maybe successful, maybe not. I would foresee maybe something like that in the Badger II medicine. Probably more is maybe a guilt trip by the government. We haven't treated them well, we're going to do something. I don't think that's the right answer, but it may be the answer that's going to happen. It'll be more impacted with fishing and hunting and just access. There's people being in there. In the 60s or 70s, I'd get on a horse or just hike down to the Two Medicine and go fly fishing 4 hours just to lose myself. And catch a few nice big trout and a bunch of small ones. And last time I know there was a couple of years ago, and fished pretty hard and got one middle-sized one, and there's lots of tracks up and down the pieces of the river where you can see tracks. So there's just more impact. It's the mobility of people. See so many Great Falls and get in this big four-wheel drive, pick up the trail and bring a bunch of snowmobiles up there in 3 hours, and you have a lot of people out there. And that's the significant change, I think.
And so you think a lot of the increased use are from non-residents?
Yeah.
So it's a recreational ground for people from outside the area.
Yep, it's a nice place. And of course, some of the homesteaders now originally it was an opportunity for them to use the land, and now homesteaders are seeing it more as a pristine area that ought to be preserved and protected. And imagine you'll interview some that are pretty upset, maybe already have, pretty upset with the cows on their property because they don't understand open range law and need to build a fence to keep the cows out. So that's another conflict that's certainly extant. Love it to death.
Great. Well, I appreciate your time and your memories. If you have anything else you'd like to add, please do. I certainly have enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad somebody's taking all this down.